This episode is brought to you by the Inspire Collection by Kalia. Just because you're working out doesn't mean you shouldn't look fabulous. The Inspire Collection by Kalia was designed with both style and performance in mind. It looks good, feels good, and stays put no matter how you move. And the collection has everything you need for a day at the gym. A support bra, crop tanks, bike shorts, amazing leggings, and more. It's their most versatile collection yet. Shop the Inspire Collection by Kalia now, exclusively at Dick's Sporting Goods.
Morning, guys. How are you?
All good, Claire. Morning.
Morning, team. How are we doing? I'm good.
We survived the release of episode one. I think it was a success.
I think it was, to be fair.
I think the feedback's been very positive so far. So
yeah, it has.
So I've ordered my coffee, my Redemption Roasters coffee, as I got told to, Rob, using the code BANGEDUP25 to get my 25% discount off.
What did you go for?
I went for the Aylesbury roast, named after their first roastery. What's
roastery.
It called?
A roastery, yeah.
So I went for Aylesbury because that is one of my most frequented prisons. So I thought it would be only appropriate.
Well, there you go. I mean, you can't say that about every coffee, can you? That you can link it to your favourite prison.
I didn't say favourite prison. I did not say favourite prison.
No.
Hopefully the coffee is calmer and smoother than the prison. I'll feedback next time. But no, I'm very excited. So thank you, Redemption Roasters. Well, we actually met up this week in person, socially distanced, didn't we? That was nice. Haven't seen you guys in so long.
We literally got the band back together for a socially distanced photo shoot where we look like the world's worst band. Apart from Boats, who is just so annoyingly photogenic. I look like a graying potato and Boats is there. Claire, you're actually quite photogenic.
I've got a funny story about that. One of my mates messaged me after that saying, "Oh, I heard you was in Wands of doing a photo shoot." I was like, "What?"
A mate inside Wandsworth Prison?
Nah, one of my mates who lives around there. I'm thinking, how did you know he said, "Oh, someone drove past and saw you"? That's probably wow. It was probably that person that shouted at millennials, isn't it?
Yeah, we were getting abused.
In their big car, they have a big car. No, that was fun. I liked the fact that at 8 months pregnant, Boats was too scared to ask me if I was pregnant when he saw me.
to be fair, he was going to text me privately afterwards to see
if I'd put on a bit of lockdown weight.
He said, he turned to me, he said, "Has Claire had a tough lockdown?" Shame, I'm pregnant, mate.
I was being courteous. Never
know. What I don't understand is what would have been the difference texting me afterwards. How would that have been any less rude?
Because Rob wouldn't have been present, so you could.
He was going to offer you a PT session, Claire. Claire, I see you put on a bit in lockdown. I'll give you half price, mates, rates.
I'll need it in a couple of months. So that was fun. Also in the independent top 100 podcast to listen to this week.
I think we might redo that. I think it's actually the Telegraph. Is it the Telegraph or Times? We are in a major publication's top 100 podcast. Probably in all of them, actually. It should be all of them.
So any other takers, we'll climb up the list. Any other papers?
Top 100, top 500, you know.
Has anyone seen what number, or does it not do that? Does it just
again,
say?
Behind a paywall, I'm not paying for that.
We've not seen it.
I just know we're in the top 100 and I'll take that.
We don't know if it's numbered.
Boats, well, you have maybe a Telegraph subscription, don't you? Can you check for us?
Yeah, I think we're that 10th, to be fair.
Maybe we'll keep climbing. Watch this space.
You know, Al was going to do, when we were in Rochester, he was going to start a blog called 25 Copies of the Sun and a Guardian. Because when we used to go and get our papers on a Sunday, there were 25 copies of the Sun and then just Al there collecting his copy of the Guardian. Yeah, I'll have that, please.
Not the Financial Times. Telegraph.
Yeah, Times crossword.
Well, we've got someone else you know on episode 2 this week.
We've really branched.
We promise you, they're not every guest.
It's not just our mates.
He's Robin Boat's mate.
It's mainly our mates, but not exclusively.
Chris, also known as Quaddy.
Quaddy the legend.
Quaddy the legend. Why is he such a legend, Boats?
I said this story the other day. He's just so funny. Rob always used to walk around the gym, the jail with him, topless. He just loves being topless. As I said before, we were on Rob's Rob's phone in his cell, trying to go on FaceTime, and he was struggling for signal. So he held the phone above his head. I said, "What are you doing, Quads?" He was like, "I thought you have to hold it in a selfie so you get better signal." And that's just the memory I'll always have of him.
He got a very long sentence, 34 years originally, but he'll tell us. Yeah, he'll tell us coming up, the story behind that.
You couldn't
write
it, could you? I mean, this is a guy, 14 years in prison, straight out into lockdown.
There probably weren't any, were there mobile phones hanging around when he went in?
When would that have been?
Some sort.
2000, pre-iPhone, definitely pre-smartphone.
Definitely pre-smartphone.
Maybe a Motorola or something, maybe like one of the later Nokias.
Not everyone, Boats, was born with a smartphone like yourself.
I was born with a smartphone. I must have been in like year 10 when phones, like when the camera phone came, that NEC one, that big one.
Claire, what was your first mobile phone?
Zanko? It was not a Zanko. Explain what a Zanko is for those who don't know.
See what I mean? It's all coming out now.
Rob knows Zanko, too much about it.
Zanko is those ones that are about the size of your thumb and they can't get picked up by detectors, isn't it? It's the mobile
and
phone
they
of
fit,
choice for inmates.
They fit nicely.
They fit
or nicer. Snugger.
Boats knows all about that.
You've definitely plugged a Zanko before.
I can say hand on heart, I have never plugged anything.
I think we'll leave the listeners to guess what
the tone has really dropped here, hasn't it? The tone has dropped.
All right, we're going to move on from that. Back to Chris/Quaddy. He'd recently been released when we spoke to him, and you'll hear how tough he was finding things, actually.
It's been quite difficult, really, because, you know, you just got to get all your life back on track, haven't you? You've got to find a place to live and that, and you come out to nothing. In some ways, I'd be better off if I was a lifer, you know, because they don't have a confiscation and they get to keep their money. So when they get out, they've got something to come out to, haven't they? But with me, I've got to start all over again. So I'm all right. I'm still getting by, you know what I mean? Just got to build it up all again, haven't you, really?
One thing that I really wanted to focus on tonight that I think is something we haven't discussed before on the podcast is...
Yeah.
Miscarriages of justice. So, you know, if we sort of explain, you maintain that you are innocent of the conviction that you, of the offences that you were convicted for.
Yeah, I was,
I
got stitched up, by my co-defendants.
By your co-defendants. Yeah. So take us back to, 2005?
I originally got charged for conspiracy to... supply ecstasy pills, which was quite minor in the scale of things as what I'm in for now, but that's where it all started, was the ecstasy pills, and I was not guilty to that. They got found in someone's back garden and in a tire and wheel, and there was no evidence on me apart from the guy who's had the pills in his back garden decided to say that I instructed him to go and pick him up off someone off the M25. And that was enough to put me on remand, yeah? So I was in remand. And then 6 months later, some yacht captains, they decided to implicate me into what they was in for. They was in for a conspiracy to import 28 key of Class A. And they dragged me down with them, really. They just said that they were working for me. So, so then the police, they joined the two cases together to really, like, make it a lot worse, really. You know what I mean? So, my case is just literally people saying things about me. There's no, like, phone evidence or surveillance or anything like that. It's all... what's come out of my co-defendants' mouths. They have really, really put me in it, and I've been found guilty over it, really.
Did you think you'd be found guilty from the evidence?
No, not even my barrister in that. My barrister, we didn't even think it would make it to court because... I went to a place called Lewis Crown, which is down near Brighton. That's where I originally started off. And the judge there was very frustrated with the prosecution because he was saying, you know, you're just taking the word of two villains, you know, and he was going to throw it out, yeah? And when the prosecution realised this, they changed the court to Hove Crown Court, which is Lewis's sister crown. And the judge got changed the last minute, and another judge called Judge Niblett, he decided to take it on. And then the court hearing went ahead, the trial went ahead, you know, which was, unfortunate, really. But then, then I had a trial, and I just got found guilty on their word, really. That's what happened.
I remember you saying to me, Quaddy, what was it when you went in for the verdict? Your barrister said there is not a jury in the world that will convict you on that evidence.
Yeah, I promise you. Yeah, that's what he said. Yeah. I even told all my family. He said, "Don't worry, he's going home and all that. Get prepared, he's going home." And then they found me guilty for some reason.
And then you get handed a 34-year sentence. That must have been...
No, not straight away, no. We had to wait about 3 months before a sentence because my co-defendants, where they was on, they went Queen's evidence. So I couldn't get sentenced the same time as them. They got sentenced separately. They got sentenced before me. And then it took about 3 months to sentence me. And then, yeah, they got 34 years. But what it was two 25s running concurrent and a 9 running consec, which was for the ecstasy pills. You know, so I got found guilty for all 3 counts.
I mean, what did that feel like to get that enormous sentence when you know you haven't done it?
Do you know what? I didn't care less about the sentence because I always thought, you know, this ain't going to, you know, I'm going to get it thrown out, you know, on an appeal. So I didn't really care about the sentence. I was more interested in overturning the conviction.
Mm. You
know? So I spent 15 years trying to appeal my conviction, and I've just had no luck, really. It's just been one disaster after another.
I mean, talk us through the stages of that. So relatively soon after you were convicted, you got an appeal against sentence.
Yeah, because my original... legal team, because the ones I had in my trial, I sacked them the minute I got sentenced, and I got a new lot, and they was doing my appeal, and then when we paid them, they abandoned it. Oh, we didn't have enough evidence to go to the appeal court, so we paid them, and they refused to pay us back the money because obviously they hadn't done nothing, but they did say that they said they had done like phone calls to my sister, which was like £1,500. This made up a ridiculous invoice for us. And I ended up taking them to the Solicitors Regulation Authority, and the maximum they can pay out is £1,500. And the only way you can get more than that is if you contest the bill, which costs more money. You have to lay more money out, and I've never done that in the end. But anyway, they lodged an appeal, which counted as an appeal, which I didn't know, and that really did screw me, really, because I had to go through the CCRC then, and then the CCRC. I don't know if you know that, but they set the bar so high, it's almost impossible to get past the CCRC to get to the appeal, and I was just like, you know, it's just impossible. And I've done it, and recently actually, and I've just got another knockback. And their reply was, because I did prove that the two people that went Queen's evidence had lied in my case, and they agreed, but because, you know, I proved that, but they said they were, you know, I didn't prove that they lied about my involvement in the case. I just proved that they lied about different aspects of the case. So I got a knockback on that one. So, but I'm still going to appeal because, you know, I'm on a 15-year licence, and, you know, I've actually been convicted of something I didn't do. So I'm still going to go ahead with appealing.
One of the things I learned going through, I think you have a perception of how the legal system works before you're involved in it. And then you go through it and you kind of see, you have this kind of idealised version of, oh, it's kind of quite a good system for figuring out who's broken the law and not. And then you go through and you feel it's just this kind of game that goes on where no one's, you know, on, especially from, you know, from, you hear enough stories from the prosecution side that they're just looking to get a conviction instead of actually trying to find out, you know, you heard enough stories where there was kind of, you know, they feel that just getting that conviction, or they, you know, and my perception of it is that they think that they... they think they've got their guy and they'll just do whatever they can to kind of get that conviction. You hear enough stories like that. And when Quaddy told me his story in prison, I mean, it is an unbelievable story, the full thing. We won't get a chance to go into all of it tonight.
Yeah,
but, you know, I'd detailed. Kind of heard enough to think that, yeah, I'd spoken enough to Quaddy to realise I didn't feel like he was exaggerating. I kind of believed him. But, you know, it is such an unbelievable story. But then, small world, we had the same lawyer.
Yeah.
And my lawyer spoke to me. I said, one of my mates is one of your clients. And she said, well, obviously not everything I can tell you, but she was like, it is like a Hollywood film when you read through this and you just wouldn't believe that someone has been given such a big sentence.
I think anyone would believe it if it was a film. They'd think it's too far-fetched. You know? It's ridiculous.
If there are any film producers out there, Quaddy is available for the story. We'll snap you up. We'll get you an agent, Quaddy.
That's still mad though. Even like when I chat to my mates about it, telling them that Quaddy got 34 years for food for drugs. That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I know people that have killed people that have got less.
You're a record holder, aren't you, Quaddy?
I've met loads of people that have come in after me and then got out before me and have killed people. You know what I mean?
That's
ridiculous.
Fucked. That's mad.
Yeah. And I ain't even got any previous convictions to that. So I did get slammed hard, you know. But
that's madness.
Well, you're a record holder, aren't you, Quaddy? You were saying you've got, is that?
It's the highest one in the system. Yeah, because a lot of people, they get like 28 years and stuff for drugs, but then some people might get a 10 on top of that for a confiscation. But mine was actually a straight 34 without the confiscation. If I had the 10 year confiscation, then I would have got 44. But
and what, Quaddy? How many pills was it?
It's 100,000 pills.
And you got 9 for that?
Yeah.
That's still kind of mad. That's still kind of mad, you know.
Yeah. Do you know what he said? He goes, I wish I could give you more than this. Yeah, that's what the judge said. I wish I could give you more, but the totality, I can't. So he had to cap it at 9.
Yeah. He really had it in for you.
Yeah, I mean, that's really a real swing from one judge that's about to throw it out to one who's desperate to give you more. That second one's off the Christmas card list, isn't he?
Yeah, no kidding, yeah. But, Yeah, it's just because the people that went Queen's Evidence, where they dressed it up so much, they made me sound like the most evil person in the world, you know, like a Pablo Escobar kind of character. And the judge and the jury, they just fell for it. And they obviously sentenced me on what they've said. So, you know, where they got carried away, they even said that they saw 600 grand on my kitchen table. And you know, they haven't even been to my house. I haven't even got a kitchen table. And it's just lies. They were saying that I was living in this like multi-million pound house, And I've just felt like saying, but where I've never been to court before, I didn't know whether you could do it or not. I thought, can we just stop this trial and let's go and have a look at my house, Because this is blatant lies, you know what I mean? My house is just like a tip, you know what I mean? I was going to knock it down and build a new one, but it weren't like what they were saying it was, you know?
It's a good episode of Through the Keyhole.
Yeah, exactly. I really didn't know how the trial system worked. I was so naive to it. You know, even my barrister said, oh, look, you're probably better off just saying yes and no to the answers, which was not the right advice to give, because the jury, they needed to know the chronology of what went on, you know, that the fact that they was in prison together for, you know, like 6 months, and they all put their heads together to like implicate me into their crime, you know, and they didn't know all that, the jury. They, you know, it was so complicated that, you know, I wish I could do it all
but
again.
In simple terms, I think on that, so your take on that, Quaddy, was that there were three guys that were accused of a crime and they thought that you had stitched them up. They thought you had gone to the police and in retaliation, they thought they'd stitch you up.
That's exactly right. And I think after a while, they just wanted to believe it, you know. And when you want to believe something because it goes in their favour, that the whole trial could have been kicked out. If I was
it feels to me, in layman, like someone that doesn't, that feels like quite an important detail in terms of like someone's possible motivation for suggesting that it was all your idea and stuff. You know, I mean, that's the stuff that kind of absolutely blew my mind when you told me all the story.
My defense in court, you know, my defense was the reason why they're doing what they're doing, going Queen's Evidence, because they thought that I brought the police to them, you know, or they wanted to.
Quaddy, what did your codees get?
They got the guy with the pills, he got the same as me. He got 9, yeah?
Yeah.
But the guys that went Queen's Evidence, they got 6 through 3. So what happens is, when you go Queen's Evidence, you get...
Just explain to people that might not know what Queen's Evidence is.
Well, it's basically, it's you become a prosecution witness, yeah? So you're helping the prosecution. And you have to convict that person, otherwise you won't get your credit, yeah? And what credit they get is a third off for going guilty, and then they get a third off for going Queen's Evidence, and they get any further that will... any further bonuses that the judge wishes to grant, like they don't get confiscation and things like that. So they're laughing all the way to the bank, really, you know. it's like, you know, especially if they don't like you, they've done the crime, basically, haven't they, really? They brought the drugs into the country on a yacht and that, and they get away with getting out after 3 years without a confiscation, just by throwing me under the bus, you know?
And how do you, are you aware, how do people go Queen's Counsel? Do they get approached to do it, or do their legal team approach the CPS? Is it something that you were approached for?
I think it's something that they would have approached the CPS.
Hmm.
I think they would have done that. Yeah. I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure, because they both had the same solicitors and all that. So that was like, I should think they would have approached the prosecution. Yeah. But I don't know that well.
I mean, it's amazing resilience that you've shown to serve 15 years when you maintain your innocence and to sound this calm and collected about things. You know, it must have been incredibly frustrating. How did you manage that on a day-to-day basis?
I don't know, really. It was frustrating because you think that no one believes you, not even your family, you know what I mean? But it's hard, you know, it's hard to try and work out how all the, you know, the justice system works and that, and trying to do an appeal and all that sort of stuff. It is hard, but, you know, it's done now, but...
That's one thing about you, Quaddy, that we always used to love. That obviously we met you at the latter end of your bird, but you was always still happy. He's always still happy. He was always dancing in the gym. he was always having a laugh. And being in jail, you see a lot of people turn mad, and you didn't. You didn't. Yeah. So that's big.
I had it not so much difficult, but I had a different experience to most, where I was in Rye Hill, I got took out of there and I was made high-risk ACAT back in 2007, I think that was. And, so high-risk ACAT means you're double ACAT. And I got put in Long Larton. I was taken from Rye Hill in an ACAT van, and I got took, you know, there was a police escort with helicopters and everything. They rushed me to Long Larton, and I didn't know where the hell I was going and what was going on or whatever. And then I ended up staying there for 3 years on high-risk ACAT. And I got dropped down to ACAT for another 4 years. So I ended up staying in Long Larton for 7 years before I got my BCAT. And in that time, I was taken to Belmarsh Unit as well to do my confiscation. Because they wouldn't let me go to any other court apart from the one in Woolwich, which is one you can get to under the tunnel sort of thing.
We might just have to go back just to explain a few things, because this is really interesting. And when we talk about double ACAT, I mean, we've spoken about categorization before on the podcast, but actually I'm not sure we've gone into double ACAT, and that is when they consider you to be an escape risk. It's the highest security you could be.
It's very rare they make you high-risk ACAT for someone who's in for drugs. Like I've met a lot of different prisoners and who are in for drugs and stuff, and there's hardly anyone who's literally, you could count how many there is on one hand, you know what I mean?
It's like, usually reserved for violence
and terrorists, terrorists. It's because it costs so much money, you know, because you get a screw who's with you all day. I call it a high risk screw, and it costs a fortune. You know,
didn't you have quite a high profile next door neighbour when you first moved into the unit, didn't you? Was he one of your,
I imagine.
Yeah, I've had a few, like Abu Hamza and what's his name, Abu Qatada and all that. That was all high risk when I was high risk, you know. And yeah,
what did it feel like? When you're in there, though, when you're like seeing the other people in there and then there's you, what kind of, how hard is it hard to like kind of process that, or how do you deal with that?
I don't know. I don't really get, you don't really know who these people are until like afterwards sometimes, you know.
Mm.
But everybody's, you know, just some people are like portrayed differently when on the TV, but everyone's like, all right, you know what I mean? When you get to know them, you know, it doesn't matter who they are, still nice people. And they, even though I've done bad things, they could still be quite all right people, you know what I mean?
That's true.
But, yeah.
And then just going back, you mentioned their confiscation proceedings. So, just explain a bit more what that is. In fact, Rob, did you have confiscation proceedings as well?
I did, yeah.
Yeah. With a confiscation, yeah, it's basically a fine. So what they do, they try and do a thing called a proceeds of crime, and they try and add up all the things, that, you know, like lifestyle, what you've bought, like cars and all that sort of rubbish. And they add it up to a ridiculous figure. So mine was like 3 million, yeah? And they say, right, this is your fine. Your fine's 3 million, you got to pay it. It's like a benefit figure. And what they do as well, they say it's hidden assets, okay? So that's the only thing that you can get time for, is a hidden asset. So if they drop the hidden assets, you're all right, because then the benefit figure, you do have to pay eventually if you come into any money, but it's not like you have to go to prison for it. So it's the hidden assets is the one, but it is just a fine, really, and you've just got to pay it off by all your realisable assets. So your realisable assets would be your house and whatever you've got around you, and they take them, and then it drops down, the fine drops down, you know what I mean, until you've paid it.
And it's a process that happens after you've been convicted, and sometimes years after you've been convicted by the time it happens. Yeah. And you return to court, and, you know, you've had to declare what your assets are, and then a judge deems the value of the confiscation order and all of that. So it's a formal court hearing that you go back to.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's the same judge that you have in the trial. And obviously, my one, he hated me. So, you know, I was up against it again. But, yeah.
So, sorry, I think I interrupted you with those questions. You were telling us a story about how, as a double KA, you got taken to Belmarsh for your confiscation proceedings as the local prison. Yeah.
Yeah, because I'm not too sure what was going on, but they thought I was going to try and escape from court, at the time.
Did it cross your mind?
I can honestly say, I swear to God, I had no intentions of escaping. This is all make-believe stuff that the prosecution have made up, you know what I mean?
But I reckon it's quite hard to escape. It would be...
They just I don't know what they was playing at. But, anyway, so they took me from Longlarton to Belmarsh unit to do my confiscation. And eventually I didn't even go to the court, Woolwich. They done me by video link. Yeah. Because they was that paranoid that I was going to try and escape, that they said, right, you're not even going to Woolwich Crown. You're going to do a video link. And I was the first person to do a video link for a confiscation in this country, apparently.
What's your day look like in a double A cat when you're in the unit? What was your day?
Being a double A cat ain't a punishment yet. It's just literally the security. So it's no different, really, from, say, what you was like in Rochester. But the unit, it's like a little, it's like, there's four spurs, yeah? There's two upstairs and two downstairs. And there's about 12 cells in each spur thing, yeah? And it's like an old people's home, really. They've got like a little gym there. They've got their own education and stuff. And it's all right, because they let you out all day. It's not like they're banging you up all day and all that. Yeah, it's all right. Yeah, it's all right. It's better in Longlarton, though, because you've got kitchens and all that there, and the gym's proper, and it's all right. It's really good, actually. It's not too bad. Yeah.
You almost sound wistful, like you want to go back.
Well, I met some good people there, you know what I mean? Mm. Do you know what? I haven't got a problem with how the jails work. It's just really the justice system, how that works. It's so bad, you know. in this country at the moment, their answer to everything is just to up the sentencing and put people away for longer and longer. And it's just not right, really. It's just so unfair how the justice system works, you know.
Well, it's so inconsistent, I think, as well as what we said earlier. You get two judges who get the same evidence put in front of them, and one of them's like, right, we'll throw this out. And the other one's like, can I give him some more time? I mean, that is, it's crazy that in the same system you get that kind of, that big fluctuation.
It's just so, you shouldn't be, it's the problem with this country, they've got this conspiracy thing as well, and they don't need a lot of evidence to convict you anymore. It's just ridiculous, you know. It's, you know, I've been convicted, I've told you before, I've just been convicted on what they've said, and that shouldn't be allowed. They shouldn't allow Queen's evidence to be convict someone solely on their evidence, you know what I mean? It should have something to back it up, like phone evidence and all things like that. But it's not. It was just solely their evidence, which, you know, it shouldn't be allowed.
Because you were on the elbow for a bit, weren't you, as well, Quaddy, at the end? Was it you said you noticed when they took up a little spot in the end of your terrace, hadn't they, or something?
Yeah. So they put me under surveillance, but they didn't use it because it was useless, because I wasn't doing anything. Yeah. And the reason why they put me under surveillance is because when they went Queen's evidence, I was obviously on the out, yeah, and they was in prison. And the police would have said to them, well, hang on a minute, you're blaming some geezer on the out who we don't even know. You know, we're going to need a bit more than that. So what they'd done, they set up a surveillance team on me to try and gather more evidence against me, you know, because obviously their evidence wouldn't have been enough for what they thought anyway. So they put a surveillance team on me and I was absolutely doing nothing. And then I just left it, sort of thing. You know what I mean? And they arrested me later on. Once that ecstasy pill thing. Yeah. So once they arrested him, he's gone to the police station, this guy, and he's turned around and said that I instructed him to pick up the pills off someone off the M25. And that was enough to remand me. And then obviously that was what I was charged for originally. And then after that,
that's even man that you got remanded for that.
Yeah, I shouldn't have. Do you know, I had not a duty solicitor, but a rubbish solicitor. Yeah. And they said, oh, don't worry, you're going to get bail for this because I can't, you know what I mean? Cause there's only his word. And it wasn't, this guy who said this in the police station, he said, yeah, Quaddy instructed me to pick it up off someone off the M25, this Tyrone Will with the ecstasy pills. But in the next breath, he's turned around and said, oh, actually, that Tyrone Will got thrown over the fence into my back garden. That's how it got there. But even though he said that, that was still enough to put me on remand. The fact that he said that I instructed him to pick him up off someone off the M25. So that's all I was originally on remand for. And, you know, even my family, we thought, oh, this is nothing. I'm going to get away with this sort of thing, you know, and it's nothing. But like 4 or 5 months later, them two yacht captains decided to go Queen's evidence on me. And what happened was they ended up charging me for that and they joined the two together. So they joined the ecstasy tablets with the importation. So it was just like to muddy the water, really. It's just all bad character, really. That's how they done it, and they put it all together, and I think it just complicated it made the whole case very complicated to the jury. So, you know, they didn't even know what was going on either, really. But they actually a month before my trial, they charged me with a thing called an attempted importation that was to do with my codeine, and that was purely to use as bad character, because they never put it in my case. They talked about it. Do you know what I mean? That was a separate trial. That once I got found guilty for what I was got done for, they decided to put that one on file anyway, the attempted importation. You know.
So that in the jury's mind, that's then like, oh, it's another, you know, yeah, so it's then another just sounds thing, like it's stacking up against you.
But there was no evidence to say I was having anything to do with that. It was just ridiculous, you know what I mean? So when I did get found guilty of, got found guilty for, I wanted to take that to court after, because that was something that was left on file. But I said, look, let me fight that, because once I prove that I'm innocent of that, because obviously I couldn't prove it whilst I was in my trial, then, you know, that gives me an option of appealing my case, because they used it as bad character. But they said, no, you're not doing that, because it's not in the public interest, and we're going to leave it on file. So I couldn't even fight that one.
So it got dropped, but it doesn't count as being kind of evidence in your favour that it was dropped. It's been stuck as
because it got dropped
something
off.
Against you.
Yeah.
Damage is done, yeah.
Quaddy, you mentioned something really interesting a bit earlier, where you said that your family, after, you know, that period of time, the difficulties of maintaining your innocence with your family. And I wondered, you know, if is that something that you saw that relationship change, that, you know, at the beginning, everybody thought, okay, this will all go away. And they kind of, they backed you and they were behind your story. And then, you know, was it something that, as each of your appeals have been unsuccessful, that you've seen people change in their responses to you or start to doubt what you're saying?
I come from a very straight-laced family. So that, you know, they were supportive to a certain extent, but they obviously didn't really know the ins and outs of my case, really. And it was hard for them to get to grips with it, really. But, you know, it's hard for me to explain, because I'm no angel. I've been into bits and bobs all my life, you know. I haven't, you know, even though I've never been nicked or anything, I wasn't a 9-to-5 person, really. But
you are now.
what I was trying to get across, because my family all knew that I was up to skullduggery all the time. So when it comes to trying to explain to them that I'm innocent of what I've got done for, obviously they're going to be a bit dubious about it. But they did kind of back me anyway, you know. But it took me a long time to even myself. I didn't even know what was going on when all these people were grassing me up and saying it was me and that. And I'm thinking, why the hell are they all, you know, pointing the finger at me? I didn't even work it out until like just before my trial. You know, all the time I was on my mind, I couldn't understand why they was doing it. But you know, it's done.
And what was the reception like in prison? You know, I've definitely come across people who seem to be genuine miscarriages of justice. You know, in my practice, I've also come across some people, especially some on longer sentences, that take a lot longer to or maintain innocence for a while and then may change that position. So, you know, it's quite hard to differentiate between those that really are and sometimes those who... I'm being very long-winded about this in the end, who sort of say that they're innocent but may not be. What was the reaction you got from staff and other prisoners? Were they supportive of your case or kind of dismissive that you were just another person claiming you hadn't done it?
They don't really want to know with regards to staff. With other prisoners, you don't really just get into too much detail about your case in a way, and nobody's really that interested if you're innocent or not. But I tell you, it's difficult is when you're an ACAT, because you can't come off the book. They call it the book year when you're an ACAT. You can't come off it unless you plead guilty to your crime. Because a lot of these courses that they offer, you have to be, you know, you have to throw your hands up and say, yeah, I'm guilty, to do the actual course. And therefore, then you can come off the ACAT. And where I was pleading my innocence, it made it very difficult for me to come off the ACAT, you know. And also, I couldn't do courses because there's no courses for drug traffickers. They're all violence related, you know. So that's why I stayed on the ACAT for so long, you know. But,
a catch-22 situation that you're in with
definitely.
I think from what I've seen is that, you know, as you say, coming off that they want you to make, you know, to say that you're guilty because they view that as a potential reduction of risk, because they say, well, for us to kind of manage your risk, we need to know what your risk is. And if you don't accept you've done this, then we can't figure out what your risk is, and we're going to keep you at this high level.
They want to make it like they want to try and be seen as they're curing you. You have this like a disease that you're a criminal, or but they treat everyone the same in prison, really, which is maybe wrong, because you know, I mean, for drugs, it's totally different from someone who's just like chopped someone's head off. It's you know, they've obviously got to have psychologists and all that, and they had psychologists for me for being on the ACAT. But I'm in for drugs, and it's no just, you know, when you're trying to, you know, when you're importing drugs, you're doing it purely for financial gain, which is not the same as killing someone, is it? You know what I mean? So I don't know. It's
quite a rare situation you were in,
it was really, But they do try to make you go guilty to your crime in them dispersals, they do, anyway, you know what I mean?
And did you ever think that it would be easier to sort of bow to that pressure to progress through the system?
No, I would never, ever, ever go guilty to something of not guilty of, you know. But I've seen a lot of people do that, you know, in the dispersal system. You see a lot of people throw their hands up, you know, even though they've gone to all the effort of saying that they're innocent and fighting their trial and that, and then just to come off the ACAT, they say, hey, look, I'm guilty, because it is stressful. It is really stressful being ACAT, you know, because you just think, oh, I'm never ever going to come off this, you know.
Well, especially if you've got an indeterminate sentence, like most of them do.
Yeah,
you're not going to get released unless you've worked your way through the system.
Yeah, them IPPs and that. They almost. They almost sat there, have to really sometimes.
Boats, Rob, did you come across anyone else on your respective sentences that you felt was also a victim of a miscarriage of justice?
Yeah. Do you remember what? I'm trying to think of his name now. The guy worked in the gym with us in Rochester, quite a young member. He had a shaved head. He was the fisherman. He was on drugs charges.
I know them quite well. That's Scott Birtwistle, that one.
But
I've been in jail with all his codees, John Beer and that, and their cases, you know, they're still fighting their case now, and most of them are all out, you know.
Yeah, I mean, because I remember Scott kind of got met by the Victoria Derbyshire team on his release. He'd had a lot of publicity, because they were trawler fishermen that came back and were clocked coming back in the channel throwing bin bags over the side of the
their
rubbish, and then the spotters noted it, and then like the next morning, like 9 North Face bags full of coke washed up. And long story short, the version is that these police spotters kind of went back and kind of crossed out. We saw them throwing 12 bin bags over and saw 9 North Face style holdalls. And Scott got like 9 years, didn't he, off it? And his skippers got the guy, you know, they were on like 14 years or something, weren't they, as well?
Yeah, I know, this ridiculous evidence. One of them got 25, I think.
Which is madness. Yeah. And they were, and you know, it was all because they'd taken on some, like an immigrant lad they'd met in the pub to come and work on the boat. And who just to be like a ship hand and a deck hand or whatever. And he was texting his mates back home going, I fucking hate being on a trawler ship. Yeah. But the police said, oh, that was him texting to arrange the drop off and all this stuff. So and Scott was, do you know what? He was a bit like you, Quaddy. He was very kind of level. I think he'd said in his early days he was pretty. He found it really difficult because, you know, he'd never broken a law in his life, I don't think, just like you. And he was, but you know, so he was like, again, met him at the back end. But he's the only one I can think of. There were a couple I met as well that I didn't believe them quite as much when they said they hadn't. There was one guy I remember on IPP, I think, who'd, you know, really protested his innocence, and you know, I wasn't quite as sure on that one. But Scott was one that definitely, I 100% believed him. And you hear the evidence that they're convicted on, and that's the ridiculous thing, is you kind of think, you know, you're not putting someone away. You know, I was on a really short, you know, 9 months. You know, you could go, you know, I was in and out done. You know, taken yeah. away, you know, he was, I think he was 22, 21 when I think he, when he went away, you know, and he was, yeah. you know, you've taken away kind of five, six, seven yeah, years yeah. of guy's life. Quaddy, you know, you've gone in, you were what, you were my age, I think, when you went in, weren't you? You were like 32.
Yeah. Yeah, I was 32. Yeah, I'm 47 now. Yeah, we're coming up 48. Yeah.
Aged well, mate. That's not, they pickled you in there, didn't they?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think no late nights and that, was it, really?
No booze, no late nights. Been on that teeth whitening gel.
Yeah, yeah.
Can we tell that story? So, Quaddy, yeah. wasn't it you were, when you were at Stamford Hill? So I was chatting to Quaddy. Yeah. I was chatting to Quaddy when he was at DCAT. Yeah. And he was like, yeah. he went quiet for like 6 months. And I was like, what you been up to? I'll let you, yeah. why was it you went quiet?
I got kicked out of Stamford Hill. This is quite recent, actually. Obviously, it happened New Year's Eve, I think it was. And what they done, this team called DST, they're a designated search team. And they come, it was New Year's Eve, and they were searching everyone's car about 6 o'clock at night. It was dark. And they're looking for people bringing in parcels for New Year's Eve, you know, like for drink and all that sort of stuff. So I've pulled in the car park and I've seen loads of them in there, and they've like pounced on me and searched the car, and they found teeth whitening gel in the glove box. Yeah. And I don't know if you know, but teeth whitening gel comes in a syringe. Yeah. But because you have a gum shield and you squirt the gel into the gum shield. Yeah. And they took it and they said, oh, yeah, I explained what it was. And they said, oh, yeah, I'm sure you're right. It probably is, but we're going to still have to send it to the lab because we're saying it's an unknown substance. Yeah. So they done that and I thought everything was all right. I went back into prison. And then a few days later, or 4 days later, they've come and got me and said, right, you're going to Elmley, which is closed conditions across the road. It's like they're a cluster of prisons, Swellside, Elmley and Stamford Hill. And, yeah, they've put me in Elmley, and I thought, what? And then when I went to Elmley, the actual governor who was on my adjudication, because she said that I was going to stay there and everything was going to be okay, she actually got a job in Elmley. She shortly followed me over to Elmley, and she took my adjudication over there, and she said, I'm really sorry, Mr. Quaddy, and she chucked it out. So she said, oh, we'll try and get you back over as soon as possible, back to Stamford Hill. And what happened was COVID coming, wasn't it? COVID coming about February. Was it February time? Yeah, so COVID come in and they've turned around and said, right, there's no out of area, no moves, no transfers. So I was stuck in there for 6 months in bloody Humbly, which is the worst.
There's a moral to this story, isn't there, Quaddy? Don't use teeth whitening gel.
Yeah, or hide it a bit better.
What was your experience of prison during COVID? I mean, obviously, you were, unfortunately, you had to go back to closed conditions when you were in open prior to that, and you got stuck there. But, you know, regime-wise and things.
Well, where I've been in for such a long time, you build up a lot of a friendship network, didn't you? Because it's a small world prison, and every jail I go to, I know people. So when I went to Elmley, I knew a lot of people. There's actually people from where I'm from, because I'm from, like, Ascot way. And there's one of my friends there, so I sort of doubled up with him in one of the double cells there. And but because of the COVID, it was 23 and a half hour bang up there, so it was torture. You know, even though I really get on with this guy, even the smallest things started to irritate you, you know, after a while. But luckily they gave me a job in the gardens there, because they say it was an essential worker at the time, so I was getting out during the day in the summertime, which was all right. So, but yeah, and then eventually I got back to Stamford Hill after 6 months, and then I'd done the last 3 months in Stamford Hill, which was all right, you know what I mean, because you're never banged up there and you're just out all day, so it was all right. Yeah, not too bad.
Normally for a place like Stamford Hill, you'd be able to go out on Rottle to go to work, for example, but that got restricted with COVID, did it?
Yeah, there was no rolls. They just started to do rolls just about 3 weeks before I got released. So I managed to get a couple of rottles in. But what happened was, is when I got, I was supposed to get released because I got nicked on the 29th of September 2005. Yeah. And that's when I should have got released. But they turned around and said I weren't allowed my police station day. So I had to do an extra 4 days. But I was, but oh, they really dug their heels in. They said, right. So, yeah, so I had to do an extra 4 days.
Right. I've been here for 15 years, lads. Maybe you can give me the 4 days. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. But you know, you get them, you get those bits of paper and it tells you your release dates, doesn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. Well, for my whole sentence, it's always been the 29th of September 2005. So I've always thought I was going to get out on that day. But when I got kicked out and went to Elmley, they changed it and said, oh, actually, you're not entitled to them days because you're not allowed to tie you into your police station days. I thought, what? And then and then they added them to my sentence. So I had to do an extra 4 days, which was, I thought it was quite cruel.
The longest 4 days of your sentence, was it?
It was actually, yeah. It was. I think it was. It really was. Yeah.
How many prisons had you been to in total, Quaddy?
Over 25 different ones. Yeah. But that was mainly because when I come away in 2005, I don't know if you know, but all the prisons were overcrowded. And they had to do a lot of lockouts, yeah? And where I had two cases, I had one in Reading and I had one down in Lewis and Hove, yeah, because my original one was in Reading through the pills, the ecstasy pills. Now, they're in two different catchment areas, yeah, you know, for the transport, you know, the Reliance and the G4S, they're two different transport companies, yeah. So one catchment area would be Wandsworth, Lewis, Brixton and Elmley, and then the other catchment would be Bullenden, Woodhill, up further up north, yeah? So when I went to Reading, I always went to those jails. And then when I went to preliminary hearing down in Lewis, I'd go to one of the Wandsworth, or even one time I got put in a police station because all the prisoners were locked out. So I had to stay in a police station for a few nights, yeah.
You've been around the houses then, Quaddy?
Yeah, so that's why I got moved around so much back in when I was on remand. That's when I done the most jails. But
What's the worst prison you've been to? What was the worst place you've been?
Do you know what? All the jails are like, they've got their good points and their bad points, you know? The worst jails, the roughest ones, are the remand jails. So, you know, people say, oh, the dispersals are the roughest, but they're not. They're all right, you know. It's very rare there's any like real bad violence or anything like that. But yeah, definitely the local jails, they're the worst ones, you know. You know, when you get to places like Rochester and Coldingley and High Point and all them sort of CCAT jails, they're all really good, aren't they, really?
We were laughing in Rochester, mate. Tops off exactly. In the summer, going doing flyer in for the over 40s football. I've never seen Quaddy happier. I've never seen Quaddy happier than when he and I used to get sent up topside in Rochester to go and do the flyering. He'd come out, biggest smile on his face, T-shirts off, and he'd be like, right, slow down, we're going for a little wander.
Yeah, I like
we'd be gone for about an hour and a half.
I like to get sunset. Yeah. Yeah.
He does have a tan on, Quaddy.
Quaddy, I'm going to finish on two questions that we have been asking all our guests this series. Quick fire questions. So the first is, if you could change one thing about the criminal justice system, what would it be?
The criminal justice system. Well, I'd like to change the fact that they're allowed to use Queen's evidence, because I think it's ridiculous, you know. As far as prisons are concerned, I don't think it's really the prisons for, you know, they're under pressure, aren't they? So that's just somewhere you get housed. I think it's the problem is actually the courts and stuff, you know, that's where the problem is. And the amount of time that they give people nowadays is ridiculous. You know, 20 years ago, you would have got 15 years maximum for a murder, you know. But now they're giving you 30s, 35s, 40-year wrecks. You know, it's just ridiculous. It's just got really out of hand. But, yeah, the thing I would definitely change is the Queen's evidence thing. I don't think that should be allowed, you know. There's a lot of things you could change, but that is one.
There are, but that's when we got to limit it.
Yeah.
And then our second quick fire is, if you had to spend another year inside, who would be your dream cellmate, dead or alive?
I really don't know. I don't know. I quite enjoy being on my own, really. I don't really like being in a cell.
Fair enough, yeah. Fair
Could you
enough.
Have a woman, no? Or is that just...
Listen, it's a dream, yeah. Exactly.
Oh, Quaddy gives me joy. Yeah.
It's been so fascinating. Thank you, Quaddy. And I think, no offence, lads, but it puts your sentences into perspective a little bit.
Well, yeah. Say that. Yeah.
So, no, we really appreciate it. Thank you. It's been great. No,
thank you. It's really good, isn't it?
Good luck with your next steps and your appeal, and I really hope that you get the outcome you deserve.
Yeah, I hope so too. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'll let Rob know anyway what happens.
We'll keep everyone posted.
Yeah.
Quaddy, what a story, to be fair. I enjoyed that. Rob, have you actually spoken to him since?
Yeah, I have actually. He was on good form. I spoke to him about a week ago. I think he's I think he has found it a bit tough. Coming straight out of prison into lockdown, but I think he's getting there. And then in true Quaddy style, I asked him for a photo that we can use on our Instagram. He sent me a couple of topless ones, which I didn't ask for, and then one of them sitting in a Ferrari. So there, Chris Quaddy for you, ladies and gents. Just what a funny character, and hell of an episode. I hope everyone enjoyed that.
Yeah,
brilliant. Well, you asked people this week on Instagram, Rob, some questions to get their involvement. Should we go through a few of them?
Yeah, we did. We wanted to hear from you lot we thought we'd start with an easy one for series two. It was asking what your favourite prison-based films or TV shows were. I think we said we should have caveated that with, it's taken as read that Shawshank Redemption is going to be up there. Literally everyone has gone
still proving popular,
which we've just realized today that Boats was 3 years old when that film came out, so that's good.
He's not seen it. That's your homework this week, Boats.
Yeah, I'm actually gonna see it.
He's definitely gonna watch that now. So we had a lot of Shawshank Redemption, but then we had Orange is the New Black. I've not seen that, Claire, any of these? That's there. That was like a Netflix series, I think. That was about...
Yeah, very American. Movie. But I think one of the first times we'd seen, I suppose we had Bad Girls, which was about prison females, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Bad Girls. I vaguely remember that. And then we had another one on there, which I had to Google, called Wentworth, which I think was about women's prison. So
I think I've got... Oh, no.
Maybe a gig else. For Babs in there from episode one. We'll speak to Babs. She can kind of work maybe as a consultant on these shows to kind of... correct the bits that they are getting wrong, because that was the second part of the question we asked. What are the bits that they always get wrong in these shows?
That's because we got interviewed by The Independent this week.
We did indeed. We did
online The Independent, but online. I'll take it. And the lovely lady who was interviewing, she said to me, what do the TV shows always get wrong? And I couldn't think of a good answer at the time, actually. I mean, I know that I'm a super annoying person to watch what is trying to be a realistic
I bet you I crime just echo, no, that doesn't happen. No, the chair, they don't use those chairs.
but I couldn't think of a good one. But actually, some of the posts on Instagram came up with some good things that I agreed with. So someone said... someone said, when I worked at a Cat D female prison, the thing that programs got wrong was that staff and inmates never get on. And in my experience, mutual respect is a big thing. If the prisoner is decent, the staff are too, at least where I was based. And I think that is true, actually. They're always seen as, or they're quite often seen as the bad guys, aren't they? Or at friction. And there is definitely friction between some officers and prisoners, but I think there are lots of, well, you guys have spoken about lots of really positive relationships you had.
Definitely famously Mr. Mac, aka Ric Flair. But yeah, definitely a few good ones. So yeah, I think that's definitely right. It's this kind of weird kind of pantomime relationship put up, isn't it? Of like the screws being all bad, but that's definitely not true.
I've got two other good ones here.
Go for it.
Tell me what you feel about this. One person says, visits are always seen behind a glass using a phone to talk to each other.
That is true.
That's in music videos as well, isn't it?
Akon, locked up.
Great, great reference there. I mean, we do have closed visits in
this
country.
What it's like? I never had a closed visit, but is that the setup
it's,
in those?
It's rarely a phone, but it is usually like a piece of glass, like you're both in one side of a room, if that makes sense. You come in through your own doors and there will be plastic or glass or whatever in between you. And prisoners can be placed on closed visits if there's been concern that they have done something dodgy during a visit before, like, you know, tried to bring in drugs or a phone, or they've got on a fight in the visits hall or something. So you're meant to only be put on it if you're a risk for a certain period of time.
Or in one instance, I think one of my guy in the cell next to me went for a visit when we were in Rochi, and his mates turned up stinking of weed. So immediately the screws were like, right, you're on closed visits. So pro tip, if you're going to go on a prison visit, try and just mask some of the smell before you go in there.
Yeah. Some
anyone listening, there you go.
Some perfume in the car, perhaps, aftershave in
the
car.
Bit of chewing gum, exactly. Yeah. Goes a long way, I think.
I think that's definitely one that we see in videos. And the other one, I hadn't thought about this, but now I do. It's definitely true. It says, there's no cafeteria that everyone congregates in for meals.
No, there's not. There's not.
They set tables out. There's tables and like at Rochi on our wing. I think on most wings they bring tables out, don't they?
Oh, did you?
Yeah, we did. Yeah. So we'd have like those school dinner tables in on the wing. That's where you'd sit and eat. In Rochester.
You don't have to, obviously.
For both of your meals or just for one of them?
Just for a hot meal, you could sit there. I mean, you could sit there and eat your rank sausage roll thing they gave you at lunchtime.
Oh, they were out all the time on the wing?
Yeah, they didn't get folded up.
Right, yeah. Okay. Yeah, because I think a lot of people I speak to just eat in there, go and collect their food and eat in their cells.
Yeah.
So, but it's not a cafeteria of such, is it? No. It's not a school cafeteria.
Not the same atmosphere.
Not that vibe.
Going back to the favourite prison one, someone here has gone really old school and they've gone slightly left field. They've gone The Man in the Iron Mask or The Count of Monte Cristo as their favourite prison-based. Wow. And technically, I guess they're right, because The Man in the Iron Mask, you won't have seen that either, Boats, will you?
No. I was going to ask what that was.
Some of DiCaprio's finest work, in my view. Early DiCaprio, that. Technically, yeah. And if you thought prison was bad now, I guess it was probably a lot worse in the 1400s. So there you go. We have come a long way since The Man in the Iron Mask, but a long way to go, I think. I don't know if we got any other. Porridge is a classic. I actually watched an episode of that the other day. That is, again, Boats blank faced here. Ronnie Barker. Do you know who Ronnie Barker is?
You know what? I've scrolled the channels and I've seen it and I saw that.
It would have been on when we were in
black
there.
And white. It's black and white, isn't it?
No. It's colour. It was just colour. It's Ronnie Barker and Kate Beckinsale's dad, who's the other character, isn't it? Gopper or something, isn't it? That is a classic. I mean, that is classic BBC production, that.
There's a few here I've not seen. Escape from Alcatraz. That feels like a seminal film I should have seen.
Well, I think that's it. So I think we've covered all the bases. Some good rogue shouts on the films and stuff there. And then I guess we now know that literally everyone likes Shawshank Redemption, which we all knew before. But thank you very much for coming back to us with your answers. There is going to be another question. So look out for Boats or Claire doing a piece to camera on our Instagram. Boats looking, they started to sweat there. in the next couple of days.
Brilliant. See you next week, guys.
See you guys.
Cheers, guys. Have a good week. See you later.